young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Writer and filmmaker Patty Greer with us, and she did almost 10 months of massive and extensive detox from one of the deadliest and the most rancid poisons being forced into humans for more than 100 years now. Mercury poison in the silver amalgam fillings in your teeth. Millions of people are affected daily from this toxin, and the ADA, FDA, and the AMA are continuing to allow it due to a large influx of what else? Money and very odd sick thinking. And let us say, Patty Greer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening, Michael. Good evening, everyone listening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Patty, sorry that you had to go through what you had to go through, but let's start from the beginning. Where was it? What experience did you have that brought you to what you were addressing tonight?
Well, you know, my expertise and my movies that I made are on the subject of crop circles and UFOs. This is my field of study, and it's a relatively new field of study for me, but my life was completely changed. I used to be a musician my entire life. I played piano and harp and sang, and I played professionally. And 7 years ago, I went to a dentist, and my intention was to get the mercury out of my mouth and to put in white fillings and one gold crown. We had agreed on this. I laid back. He gave free nitrous. Next thing I knew, I had a mouthful of silver, brand new mercury poison fillings.
Oh, boy.
And when I call them mercury, again, this is not my expertise, but I've read so much, and now I think I've got a pretty good handle on it. These silver fillings that are being put in humans for many years are 50% mercury, liquid mercury, 25% silver, and the other 25% is other minerals that shouldn't be in a human body. Tin, copper, lead have been found in mercury fillings. And I don't even give them the respect of calling them silver fillings. They are 50% mercury. And when it comes into the dentist office or when it goes out, it has to go in special containers because it's so toxic. Hello, what goes on in between is it goes in our teeth. And this is a bittersweet story. You know, I should be selling my amazing crop circle movies that have won all these awards and taught me amazing things about the planet, which I think are extremely important. My website is pattygreer.com, P-A-T-T-Y-G-R-E-E-R. But I think my generosity of heart is that it took me changing the subject rather than what I'm known for.
Yeah.
I want to tell people that if a lot of people are out there with a mouthful of silver fillings and they've been sick for years and they've been to every kind of doctor and nobody can fix them, if you've been tested for mercury poisoning, chances are you got the wrong test. I got the wrong test 6 years in a row, and it wasn't until 1 year ago that I finally learned the truth about mercury poisoning and how to find the right test. For some reason, the doctor's offices and the allergy clinics that I went to in my state of Colorado gave me a test for fish and environmental mercury, which is called organic mercury. It'll never see the poison from the teeth. The teeth mercury is called inorganic mercury. It's all synthesized, and they won't find it with the other test. And therein lies the reason so many people are walking around with mercury poisoning, and they don't know what's wrong.
Let me hold you up for a minute. I want to make sure we've got this in order to bring up a point. So what we're really saying, and stop me if I'm wrong here, because this is the first time I've heard this, not about the mercury, but the testing. So in essence, it's the wrong test to discover the mercury poisoning, but it's the right test to keep everything flowing the way it has been flowing and the money flowing.
Correct.
Okay.
So what we have is two totally different blood screenings, and they don't overlap. One is organic, one is inorganic. And we know that those are two totally different testings. and two totally different tubes of blood. So for 6 years, I paid hundreds of dollars, got tested for mercury poisoning. They said, go home, go back to sleep. And I did, and my hands have had cuts all over them. I was a harpist. I was a pianist. I mean, my hands, and any normal day, I'm a human. I need them to do the basics. And it's really, really hard having cuts and dead, dying skin all over my hands. So I've been to every kind of doctor, every kind of specialist. I went to every kind of hooji healer, and nobody could fix me until finally a year ago, I started looking on the internet for conscious dentistry. And I found a doctor who gave me the name of the one place that I know of in America that does inorganic mercury testing. And this is where I say, I'd like your audience to grab a pen and paper. Michael, do you have any silver in your mouth?
Actually, no.
You're lucky. Most people do.
No, I'm like you are, Patty. Smart.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't too smart. And when I went to this dentist, I had clearly not gone there for mercury. And it's just a shame that people feel it's in their best interest to do what's fast and cheap, no matter what the client asked for. And I've suffered because I went through a pretty heavy dose of it, and he should have never done this. But the wonderful thing is, I finally got the real test, and the place is called Quicksilver Scientific. It's in Louisville, Colorado. They've got a website, quicksilverscientific.com. And this guy saved my life. He tested me like all the others did, except he took blood, urine, hair, and each fingernail. And he called me personally and he said, I'm really sorry to tell you that you're in the top 5% of worst cases we've ever seen. Wow. The good news is it's what's wrong with your hands. So I've been detoxing and I've been healing, but I'm talking $17,000. Now, how many people can afford to do this? I pray that they're going to have the dentist remove what they did as soon as they start telling the truth about it. This should not be going in, people.
Patty, and let me hold you, because I think it's a very important question here. We deal with the medical profession constantly, and we're going to throw the dentist into that particular profession. When the insurance companies say that this is the only test, quote unquote, that we will pay for, etc., and people are still getting sick, and I'm sure people have died from this. The question is, ultimately, who's got the responsibility? Who is it at base that you can come back after? There was no reason, I'm sure there were reasons, but there was no reason humanely that you should have had to spend the money, go through what you went through, and other people going through this. And if QuicksilverScientific.com has the answers to this, this means that ultimately somebody has a responsibility for allowing people to get hurt and to get sick.
It's an unfortunate situation going on. I think it's about as big as the UFO cover-up. It's just another one of those things where humans deserve to know the truth. We do. And only because of how long it's taken me to heal this and how, oh my God, the agonizing years. I've gone around in gloves and Band-Aids for 7 years. And somebody just did a caricature of me in England in the crop circles with my big, beautiful camera, and I've got gloves on. I mean, the hair is great, the cleavage is nice, but gloves on. Mm. You know, I mean, this has not been fun. And the more I learn, the harder it is to deal with. So I want to give your audience two websites, because again, my movies are about beautiful things, the crop circles, 2012, positive prophecies. But this is something else. This is something that stopped my life and pretty much every aspect. But the good news is you can get tested and you'll get the truth and then you can detox. And the other thing is there's two websites that have done huge amounts of research. These are American organizations that are telling the truth about mercury poisoning in your teeth. One is called DAMS, and I believe it's Dental Amalgam Mercury Solutions, DAMS. And the other one for your audience is IAOMT. So what I'm giving you is two websites to do your own research. I don't even like to talk about it, but just going out to the flower store the other day, you know, I was trying not to wear gloves and be normal in the world. And the lady said, oh, what happened to your hands? It's like, oh, great. You know, I mean, it's for me, I have a constant reminder. I don't want to think about it, but I am detoxing still, like 15 products a day. And why? It's really wrong. This dentist was clearly asked not to do this, and there's no excuse why it's still legal. I mean, it is so dangerous to the human body. And when we go to these websites, the DAMS, the IAOMT, people will see that many, many diseases, including Lou Gehrig's, many of the people that have died of horrible diseases, when they have, sorry to say, dissected the brain, they have found huge levels of mercury. In a lot of diseases that are happening today, it's being caused by the mercury in people's teeth. The last gift I want to give you all for Christmas is a YouTube video called The Smoking Tooth. You can visibly watch what happens if you've got one mercury filling in your mouth. It is off-gassing mercury vapors 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When you brush your teeth, when you drink hot liquid, it's multiplied tremendously. And this is happening to all people all the time. I want to get to the punchline, Michael, and it hasn't been much of a discussion, but we have 18 minutes. I've got to cram. The difference in me since mercury poisoning is not what I had expected at all. I didn't realize that my brain was frenetic and I was, you know, more emotional than I would normally be. But when the mercury was peaking in me, which it has the last few years, it was pretty shocking that as I've done this 10 months of detox, my hands are not fully healed, but they're definitely headed there. But the difference in my brain and my organs is phenomenal. Clarity, peace, a slower pace. I feel like a different person, like I almost got dropped in a new body.
And let me hold you up just for a sec, because we don't quite have 18 minutes, and I want to do a shift here. I've got the websites, and we'll put them up on our website to make sure everybody gets it. I want to go to crop circles just for a moment. You know, we've heard about it for years and years and years and years. You're into it. You've studied it. What are they? What's the essence of a crop circle?
The crop circles, I think, are the first manifestation of ET communication that humans can physically see. And these are these huge, gorgeous visual gifts in fields of wheat and barley and corn. And they've been seen all over the world, but more than anywhere else, they've been seen in this 20 to 40 mile radius of the Avebury Stone Circle, which is in England, southern England, halfway between Glastonbury and Stonehenge, famous sacred sites. And as we look at a map at the end of every summer of where the crop circles land, typically they're sitting right between sacred sites on what we call ley lines. So they're not accidental. They're pretty much intentional. And many of them, most of them have sacred geometry. And those of us that study the crop circles believe that the sacred geometry is giving humanity very important information that comes to us on a subconscious level as we just look at the image of the crop circles. They are feeding us information. And what I've learned recently, and I believe it's true, is that a lot of the information coming through the crop circles is about free energy and how to create it and the mathematics and the binary codes. The sacred geometry is giving us so much information. And just by looking at, for instance, movies or pictures, images of the crop circles, my website is covered with photo libraries of the crop circles because I want people to get the information. When I lay down in a crop circle, I knew nothing about them. I went to England to heal my hands because I felt like if humans can't do it, I'm going to really stretch my wings and see if I can get some help here. And I didn't know anything about the crop circles. I laid down. I had an amazing experience of like a euphoric time before I passed out. And when I woke back up, I started taking ridiculous amounts of photos of crop circles. And within less than 2 years, I had made 4 movies. And they've won Best Feature Film at the International UFO Conference the last 2 years. Go figure. I don't really take credit for them fully. Something happened to me in a crop circle. And I believe all of this is intertwined. You know, I lost the use of my hands. I couldn't play music. And I was so desperate, I went to the crop circles. But I think that really ultimately our paths are beautifully laid out. And the fact that, thank you for asking me to talk about the crop circles, because it is so much more glorious than the unfortunate nature of mercury poisoning. But, you know, if my hands hadn't been poisoned and I hadn't felt the desperation of needing to reach out to something other than humans, maybe this wouldn't have happened for me. So it's kind of a bittersweet story. And I like telling people about the mercury now because I don't think it's fair for anybody to go through life being sick. And I know that for me, it came from my teeth, but it took me 7 years to figure it out. I hope I've saved a lot of people a lot of time. And these websites will teach you everything you want to know. And my website will be far more delightful about the crop circles and what's really going on there.
Okay, Patty, we're starting to run out of time. Your website, how do we find you?
It's pattygreer.com, PattyGreer.com. And I have all my movie trailers are there. And right now I'm actually working on my fifth movie. This time I'm editing by myself, which is a huge leap. And I'm really grateful, you know, to be able to have radio shows like yours where we can get our messages out to people, because the internet is where it's at. TV has kind of lost its glory. The news is so uninformative. You know, I saw an amazing headline recently that said people that watch Fox News know less than people that watch no news at all.
I don't know anything then. My favorite news channel. Patty, we got to go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael, and good night, everybody.
Good night.
Just go there. Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Jim Huntington with us, PhD. Works. The book is The Works, New Age, The End of Full Employment, and What It Means to You. And we're going to talk about that tonight. Jim is a business professor, a teacher, a professional speaker. His 2007 doctoral dissertation is the only book written on career jobs in post-65 baby boomers. He's also written on leadership, organizational change, human development. He has a BA in sociology from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, an MBA from the University of Phoenix, and a PhD in applied management and decision sciences from Walden University. And let us say, Jim Huntington, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When I said the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Radio Susie jumped off her chair and started doing this. Yes, yes.
UWM. I'm a Panther from way back. I'd be dating myself if I told you when, but yes, I lived 10 years. I also went to Shorewood High School in that area.
Yeah, no, she's all excited. She went to Nicolet, and she's over here going, yes, we love every second of it. By the way, the show's broadcast right outside of, well, it's in Mequon, actually.
Oh, yes, many times I went in and through Mequon. You can't go north out of Milwaukee County without getting into Mequon.
With Mequon. Okay, let's talk about this for a moment. When we are dealing with the job crisis, and the job crisis is permanent, can you define what the job crisis is? We hear so many different definitions, Jim, that I think people today are confused. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican, you're Democrat, you're in the middle somewhere. Nobody seems to have a handle on what's causing the problem. Everybody's got their own agenda, and the people that suffer are the people who can't get a job.
Well, the jobs crisis for me comes down to three words: not enough jobs. There are not as many jobs as would be needed for people to work them. And we are permanently short on them. Full employment has ended permanently. Better economic times will not bring it back. And the gap between available workers and available jobs will continue to increase.
You know, I came from a world, and probably it's around where you were, but I came from a world where we did manufacturing here. We created the jobs. It was innovation. There were things that we did. And then there was a period of time when we went global, we couldn't compete, we started to outsource, and the next thing you know, you blink your eyes, and people in China and India and all of these different places are doing what we used to do, and the people here are suffering because there's no place to go to work.
Yes, absolutely. That is one of the major reasons. There are two reasons why the jobs crisis is permanent. Two major reasons. One is automation, which is getting more and more extreme. And the second is globalization, which has reached the point where Americans are just too expensive. Otherwise, there are a string of smaller factors, such as rising health care costs and efficiencies business discover in bad times that carry on to good times, and sure, simple supply and demand, meaning wages and benefits, will head lower.
And look what we did years back with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association. We had a tremendous amount of jobs, and we created jobs in Mexico, and all the population was there that were working. They were happy. And somebody found out they could get it done cheaper in China. So they pulled all the jobs away from Mexico, threw it out into China, and those people who weren't working were starving, and they started to hit the borders here. So it's kind of an interesting catch-22 with what we deal with. I think this entire thing lies on privatization, our own capitalist way of doing things, which I'm a capitalist from the get-go, of free enterprise. And I think that's what we've lost. And that in and of itself seems as though it's the only thing that's going to get us back on our feet.
Well, the problem is that American workers are being matched in education and skills, beaten out in work attitudes, and buried in cost effectiveness by workers in other countries. Many Indian call center workers earn less than $500 a month, and they are as good as the Americans. So if you are a business practicing, as what you say, capitalism and free enterprise, what are you going to choose? Well, it's not the businesses being evil with decisions like this. They have no choice if they're being true to their stockholders and customers to get the jobs done for less money if they can. And that's what they're doing, and that's what they're going to have to do to stay in business.
Oh, by the way, I completely agree. I think when we really look at the problem, the intrinsic problem that we have here, you can't throw money into it. It's not education, because you look at the high schools today. Detroit alone has a 55% dropout, 20-30% average across the board throughout the country. Yes, we have people in other countries that have far greater education than we do. There's no incentive here anymore. We've gone into such a you owe me entitlement state of mind that it's hard to get anybody to work. This recent lowering of the of the unemployment from 9-something% down to 8-something%. They're not talking about that great percentage in the of people who gave up that didn't even want to go to work and apply for a job anymore.
Well, but that's all, Michael, what that number is about. I ran the numbers on that, and based on 310 million people and a workforce of 155 million or half of that, in order for unemployment to go from 9.0% to 8.6% when 120,000 jobs were added means over 600,000 left the labor force. That is scary. That is the entire decrease is fewer people in the labor force. And that had nothing to do with better jobs or more jobs or better working conditions or a better economy or anything. That was pure and simple, the numbers for November, people deciding they were not going to try to work anymore, most of whom were discouraged.
Now, by the way, the other thing that's happened also is if you look at the junior high school, the high schools today, the sports has gotten to a point where they don't want to do anything because if somebody gets a bruise or gets hit with a ball, they can sue the school. They wood shop like in the old days, auto shop, metal shop, all of those things are gone. And the real education that preps somebody for when they get out of high school to go to work is gone now. And they're talking about the ongoing and continuing education for college. But, Jim, that seems like it's so expensive for most families that they can't do it. And if you are illegal or if you come here on a visa, it's easier to go to college and get it paid for than it is if you happen to be a citizen in this country. So we face a lot of challenges when it comes to this.
Yes, the student loans in the country are around $500 billion right now. The cost of college has been getting higher and higher, and the workforce has been getting a higher and higher percentage of people who have graduated from college.
Yeah.
Do not realize, a lot of people may not realize, that around 1900, most Americans did not even finish high school. By 1940, only 15% of Americans were even going to college. Now, it's well over half going to college in some form, and 35% of the people in the labor force are college graduates, and that pushes the standard up so high that there are simply not enough good jobs at that level for all of them to get. So, as you say, some people are thinking they were entitled to something better, and so they get discouraged and don't want to work at any level.
I'm going to go back to what these kids are being taught as they're growing right now. It's the what I really wanted to get at before, and it just slipped. You know, you get a little older, it happens to you. But it's that competitiveness that's gone. The competition is gone, and that's what business is about. I really believe in my heart of hearts, and we'll never prove it because I don't think it's going to happen. If you go to Florida, the cost of health care is it's exorbitant. But there's only a certain amount of insurance companies that are able to do business in Florida. What would have happened if every insurance company was able to do business in every state? All of a sudden, we've got competition. We have competition. The price goes down, and they would have to throw the quality up because they've got to have a reason for someone to buy.
Well, I see no reason why health care companies or providers or insurers of any kind should be restricted to one state or one group of states or anything else, as long as they can pass the certification and required standards, which I would think, without knowing a great deal, would be similar between states. They should be able to provide it elsewhere. And absolutely, competition is a very good thing.
And, you know, I think a prime example of this, I'm sure that you've heard what's going on with the post office right now. You know, that next day service is gone. It's costing them billions of dollars to be able to do business today. The post office should actually go private. Then it's a whole different story. Then they're going to get competitive. They're going to do things. They're going to offer things to people. Obviously, we know the internet had a large dent in the postal service. But if it's government, too many regs, bureaucrats is a person. A bureaucrat is a person who isn't elected. They're paid to do a job. You've got too much money going out to watch over everything, and we complain about not having enough money. You got billions of dollars going to foreign countries to create oil reserve, not oil reserves, but to create to drill for oil, to do this to Finland for hundreds of millions of dollars to build cars. Nothing is happening here. We got all this money going out, nothing coming in, and look at the unemployment.
That is true. It is strange in many cases why we are not doing the same kind of things in our country that we're doing for other countries. But back to the post office, that's a good example of something that needs to change. The post office last year lost $5.1 billion, and that was after substantial cost cutting. So it has disturbed me, the solutions people have come up with for that. Some people have said that we need to have a campaign for getting more and more letter writing. Well, letter writing is dead. The Postal Service does two things well, packages and bulk mail. And yes, if they were a free company, they're sort of in between right now being a government organization and being a private company, and in a way they have the disadvantages of both. They're shackled and held back in many ways. I would say your solution would be good. It also could be good if they were completely a government entity and we expected it to lose money. But really, a private business, if they were allowed to focus on the things they do well, they certainly could make money. UPS is profitable. FedEx is profitable. They've found their niches, and I would think of something that covers the same responsibilities as the post office would also be profitable doing what they do best. One thing the Postal Service needs to do badly is cut wages, cut salaries. I know it's not viable to do that for existing employees to much of an extent, but new employees really cannot be paid $50,000 a year or whatever at the beginning to work for an organization like that. It's way more than they're paid for FedEx or UPS, and their labor costs are excessive and way too high.
Sure. Jim, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask the last question, and here it goes. We have just made you, we've waved the magic wand, and we have made you the king of America. In the Jim Huntington world, how would you fix all of this?
Fix it. One, I would have WPA-style infrastructure jobs projects. It will never be cheaper in labor and materials, and the infrastructure needs many things. Second, I would separate health care from jobs.
Wait, WPA is what?
Work Project Administration.
Okay.
And it is the same plan that was around in the 1930s with FDR, where many of the buildings and bridges and roads that it made are still around today. I'm not talking about paying people very high professional wages for these things, but turning unemployed people into employed people by letting them build bridges and construct buildings and that sort of thing would help the country, and it would help the economy by, instead of having them collect unemployment benefits and other services to be able to pay taxes.
Let me hold you up. We're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
Yes, you can find me at www.worksnewage.com, and you can order my book on Amazon, including the Kindle version, on barnesandnoble.com, including the Nook version, or at any bookstore by special order.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
You too.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days
'cause I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always have your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. It is a universal truth. From giving up all they've got and giving yet more, moms everywhere are sleep-deprived, stressed out, out of shape. Factor in the holidays now, and it's even worse. And between tending to their family's needs and planning holiday celebrations and activities, the last thing mom has time to do is take care of herself. Enter Dustin Mayer. He's the creator of Fit Fun Boot Camps, which in 3 years has grown to be one of the largest boot camp fitness programs in the country, a regular guest on public radio. Dustin has produced 28 home workout DVDs and has made more than 80 television appearances. His book is called Fit Moms for Life, How to Have Endless Energy to Outplay Your Kids. And let us say, Dustin, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and thanks for being here. Wait, I got to get down and do 10 push-ups, and I'm ready to rock here. You know, I think when it really comes down to it, there's so many people who just stay out of shape, and just a little bit of something would allow them, just with the moms, especially what they have to do, to have the energy and the wherewithal to get through the day and still feel good when they go to bed at night.
Yeah, you're totally right. You know, the biggest thing I see is that moms, they just feel like they have to put, you know, 24/7 energy into their kids, their, you know, their husband, their careers, whatever it may be, and they think that's what it is to be a mom. And, you know, that is definitely a big part of it, but if they're not putting themselves first, if they're not carving out that 15 to 45 minutes a day for themselves, if they're not, you know, preparing their food and eating healthy, their long-term success as a mom is going to definitely decrease. They're not going to be happy with their bodies. They're going to have lower self-esteem. They're not going to be a great example for their kids. So just having that mind shift change that, you know what, being, you know, putting myself first is not selfish. That's a huge thing for women to get around.
No, absolutely. Now, by the way, we have a tremendous amount of obesity and unhealthy people running around the streets today. What do you think caused that? You know, it's only been in the last, say, 10 years that we've really looked at it. There's always been a problem with obesity and health and everything that's attached to it. But recently, man, it's been unbelievable. What do you think has caused this?
Well, it's been, I would say, in the last 40 years is when we've really seen the spike, and especially, like you said, in the last 10 years. It's a combination of a few things. One is technology. Technology is making it so convenient for us to, you know, not move and not exercise, not work. I'm a firm believer that if we all lived on farms today and we still ate the crap that we're eating right now, we would, you know, be a lot less obese than we are. And the second and more important is just the tremendous switch over from whole, natural, fresh foods to processed junk, basically. And we're just a society living on processed foods that have very low nutrient value and have tons of toxics in it. And we just, you know, I think we also work too hard. We spend too much time working, not enough time sleeping, and it just causes this kind of endless cycle of inactivity, of overeating, eating bad, getting bad sleep, being unhappy with your body, being depressed, finding more food, and just the cycle continues.
You know, you talk about food. I remember 200 years ago when I was a kid, I remember eating a hamburger. It was juicy. It was good. It was, you know, it was a hamburger. I recently, in the last year or so, ate a restaurant hamburger, And I got to tell you, the taste was completely, it didn't even taste like a hamburger used to taste like, because of everything that they are putting into that meat and the rest of the food now, it is. It's toxic and it's killing people.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, what do I think about organic food and where should I spend my extra money when it comes to food? And grass-fed beef is one of those things that I would highly recommend people switch over to. It's just so much more nutrient, better. The fatty acid profiles of grass-fed beef is so much better than the corn and soy bean-fed, as well as all the injections they put into the cows.
Actually, in any market, I know when I shop, I will find the grass-fed. I will find, and I'll make sure that on the package it said, no antibiotics, no steroids, no et cetera. Yep. And you can find it in any market. It's not like you have to go to a special place to get this. Okay, what was it that caused you, Dustin, to look at this subject and get involved in it the way you have?
Yeah. Well, I really picked moms, I guess, kind of out of my experience with my own mom. I'm 28 years old right now. I've been a trainer for 8 years, and my mom was an awesome stay-at-home mom. She took care of myself and my three younger siblings. And once I got into college and was starting to study kinesiology, I was thinking back to kind of my childhood and how moms just really, in general, put everyone else, kind of like I mentioned before, put everyone else before themselves and just didn't really have an outlet to exercise, and maybe they didn't eat healthy. And they didn't have, you know, a lot of moms, especially stay-at-home moms, feel isolated. So when I got out of college, I wanted to create a program that would bring moms together to kind of hang out with each other. They didn't have to talk, you know, baby talk. They could talk to real adults and build that network and community, as well as, you know, get away from the kids. So we had free childcare, and we called it Mama-Tone Fitness. And so that's kind of how it started back 5 years ago after I graduated college. And from there, it's grown to kind of what you said in the intro there, then the culmination of my book coming out here.
Now, by the way, with all of the work that you've done, and I know obviously, and I'll say obviously because it's here, that you also work with pregnant women. Most people think that pregnant women can't really exercise, they can't do this because of. That's not true, is it?
No, absolutely not. And that's one of my goals as, you know, I continue to reach more and more people. Our goal here is to help 1 million moms by the end of 2015. And I really want to rewrite the medical literature on what moms can and should do while being pregnant. And we've had a couple dozen women now go completely through my programs. And my programs are definitely on the intenser side. We use, you know, a lot of resistance training and interval training cardio. And so it's tough. And every one of them have reported, you know, better pregnancies, better deliveries, you know, less weight gain, quicker weight loss once they do, and they just overall feel so much better. And, you know, it's going against a lot of the doctor literature out there. It's kind of becoming a little bit more common now that doctors are saying, well, you know, you can at least maintain kind of with the program you've been doing, just kind of, you know, bump it down a little bit. But, you know, but 20 years ago or 30 years ago, a lot of them were saying, just, you know, lay down, stay in bed all day, and that's the best for the baby. So absolutely, there's very few things that I found that moms have to really modify. Of course, the intensity a little bit. Of course, laying on your belly as you get towards your second and third trimester becomes an issue. But it's been amazing what these moms can do.
Well, by the way, I want to go back almost 15 years now. It doesn't really matter the what of it, but 15 years ago, I had to have an operation. And I was about a month out before it was going to happen. And I knew that if I stayed in the best physical condition that I could be in, that I would make it through a lot easier than if I just sat around. So I got up in the hills, and I'm running the hills and doing everything that I normally do, working out with weights. And I really believe to this day that it helped me get through it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I had a client, he was about 60 years old and great shape, like phenomenal shape, and he needed a hip replacement. He had a degenerative hip, and then he went in at the same day as this other woman who was pretty obese, and they ended up kind of being in physical therapy together, and he was just telling me the horror stories of how awful she was doing in a recovery and how well he was doing. And the, you know, the doctors and physical therapists said it's because you were in such good shape, you know, when you started.
Yeah, now by the way, the basic concepts of what you're talking about, it's not just for women, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I try to live out the five pillars that we may talk about here in the book. I try to live them out every day, and there's certainly universal truths for both men and women. And I love to hear the stories of the the wives or the husbands of the wives who are doing my program getting on board with things. And once that happens, it's really high success rate because then they're both supporting each other. They're eating together, eating healthier foods, they're exercising together, and that's really when the magic can happen.
Now, by the way, traditional cardio. So many people think that that's the only way to burn weight off, but you're saying no.
Yeah, you know, I've worked now with over 5,000 clients from all over the world, and something I was seeing was all these people coming in who had just run a marathon or run some 10Ks. They've been training, or they just been, you know, been walking a lot, and they were all unhappy with the way their bodies looked and felt, and they were just confused. They're like, I'm doing all this exercise, I'm doing 6-7 hours of cardio a week. You know, what gives here? And you know, at this time I was more into the resistance training portion, and I started to research it more. And the last 5 years has really shown in all these studies that resistance training is the best way to boost metabolism. And then from a cardio standpoint, burst training is the new kind of hip term these days, and I can explain what that is. Burst training is where you do any sort of cardiovascular exercise for only 10 seconds up to about 60 seconds. So we use running on a treadmill because everyone can picture that. So say you're running on a treadmill at an incline, say it's at 10% incline, and you're running for 30 seconds, and then you just kind of hop off the machine or slow the machine down, and you rest for about 60 seconds to 90 seconds. And then you hop back on for 30 seconds, and after that 30 seconds, your heart rate's up at about 95% of its max. So it's up there very high. And then you bring it back down, and you bring it back up. And you do that 5 to 10 times, and the research now that's been coming out is it's 5 to 9 times more effective at burning fat than steady-state cardio. And all my clients who have switched over from long-distance running, they're just blown away by the transformations physically. But then also, it's great for those who are training for, you know, 5Ks, 10Ks, marathons. It's a great way to cross-train, and it really improves their performance.
Now, by the way, let me see. We're going to go back 50-some-odd years ago. I played football in high school, and where I got exposed to that were the wind sprints. It was perfect. We get on the, yeah. And if you want to get in shape, and that's the fastest way to do it. And really what we're talking about here is you're saying, go back to basics.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, wind sprints are a great example. I really like stairs and hills because a lot of people, you know, their bodies aren't really ready for full out sprinting. It is pretty hard on the body. It's, you know, it stretches the ligaments and tendons out. So going, you know, uphill is going to definitely decrease the level of impact on the joints. But anything you can do to get the heart rate up really quickly, and it's amazing how much faster and stronger your heart gets doing that.
Yeah, by the way, I've got it all set up here. I've got stairs from the studio in the office upstairs. And the way I've got it set up is when you get all the way up, there's oxygen waiting for me. So I'm safe at the top of the stairs. No, but absolutely. If you've got stairs, it's called use them. And when you really think about it, one of the other things that I think would be a brilliant idea, especially today with what's going on, you know, Christmas is right around the corner. What a neat thing to give a mom a workout video.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, workout DVDs, you know, books, different, you know, I think dumbbells are the most universal piece of exercise equipment. That's
sure.
My DVDs that I have are just using dumbbells and a stability ball, you know, those mm-hmm. you can pick up for relatively cheap at any store. And, you know, I mean, if you really like to run or stuff, you know, you can get a treadmill, but those are so expensive, and I find that most people don't use them very much. So you might as well just stick with dumbbells and you know, DVDs and stability balls.
By the way, let me tell you what I love about the DVDs. I got, before my DVD broke, I got the P90X program. Are you familiar with that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, what I loved about that was most people, if you give them a workout regime and if they got to do it alone, they're just, Dustin, they're not going to do it. But if you got a video right. going, it's like being with someone. There's someone there
yep.
working with you, and it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And with my Fit Moms for Life DVDs that we've got, we take it a step further, and we try to empower and encourage the moms to build a community group around them. So we've got these groups all over the country where they meet in people's homes, churches, schools, workplaces to do the DVDs together. So not only are they getting the instruction from the DVDs and the motivation, they're feeding off of each other and even having greater accountability, which is pretty awesome.
No, no, and it's great. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And as a matter of fact, the Christmas is right around the corner. How does somebody order them?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, DustinMaherFitness.com, DustinMaherFitness.com, and on the left-hand side, you can see all the DVDs. But I also encourage you guys, a great free resource I have is just putting your name and email on the box to the right-hand side. I've got 450 videos and articles that I've done that are completely free for you guys, kind of my labor of love, and you'll get my free fitness newsletter. And then for my book that just came out yesterday, Fit Moms for Life, you can go to fitmomsforlife.com. That's F-O-R, fitmomsforlife.com.
Wonderful. By the way, I think it's great. I am a strong proponent of everything that you're talking about, and I would stand behind it 3,000% any day of the week. I have worked out probably over 50 years now, and it's kept me in the kind of shape that I'm in now. And you don't have to get nuts with it. It's something that it will not only will you look and feel better, but the people around you are going to like to look at you too.
Absolutely. And you'll have to email me, and I'll get you one of my DVDs. I gotta have you the expert here. See what you think of them.
Wonderful. Oh no, I absolutely will. As a matter of fact, I will shoot you a picture. Don't send me flowers when I send the picture, but just to get an idea of what we're talking about. Hey, Dustin, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Now that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold the leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Now that's all. Now that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, The Compound Effect. Jumpstart your income, your life, and your success. Author Darren Hardy with us. He's been a leader in personal development industry for nearly two decades now. As a publisher and editorial director of Success Magazine, he's interviewed leading experts on human performance and achievement, as well as many of today's top CEOs, entrepreneurs, and superstar athletes. An entrepreneur himself, he's got an earning of over six-figure income by the age of 18, by the way, and more than $1 million a year by age 24, owned a $50 million a year business by age 27, and he's mentored thousands of entrepreneurs, advised many large corporations, serves on the boards of several companies and nonprofit organizations. Popular keynote speaker. He appears regularly on the TV networks CNBC, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox. And Darren, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, good to be with you tonight.
Oh, you sound busy, Darren.
Yeah, busy indeed.
Okay, The Compound Effect. Jumpstart your income, your life, your success. In today's very stressed-out marketplace, what is that secret? What is that something that's missing that most people have in front of them, Darren, but they don't see?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's the big question. What does it take to succeed? And in today's culture, that could be a very confusing, very perplexing question. And the reason I wrote the book is, frankly, I was just sort of ticked off. I mean, I see a real injustice that's taking place in our society where people are being misled and tricked and bamboozled and really taken for fools because we're constantly bombarded with increasingly sensational claims to get rich, get fit, get younger, get sexier all overnight with very little effort for only three easy payments of $39.95.
Sure.
I think these repetitive marketing messages have distorted our sense of what it really takes to succeed, and those that have a sincere interest in learning what it takes to be more successful are constantly getting distracted or frustrated or disappointed when they don't experience the results the infomercial promised. And so I was tired of watching it happen. I felt a personal, a moral obligation as publisher of Success Magazine to sort of return people back to the basics, the truth, the core fundamentals of what it really takes to succeed, clear the clutter, demystify the truth, tell it straight, no fat, no bull, no fluff included. And that was kind of the genesis to wanting to put this all between a couple of covers and some pages.
No, by the way, with your press release, and it says choices, and you just said it, and I want to expand on it. People typically sleepwalk through life, engaging in behaviors that they are not consciously aware of. We are so bombarded with what you said, $39.95, three payments, it's yours, and nothing ever works, and you're back to square one again. That's the key. You know, when we've got all of these messages coming in, we get confused, and we do sleepwalk through life, and we miss what's really there. We don't get back to basics, and we don't get back to what it's going to take to make it in this particular economy. And what it's going to take to make it in the economy is get a mindset of 20 or 30 years ago that you can be all you can be if you want to be it, and it's still out there if you want it.
Right. I mean, you know, I think that we've all gotten lazy in this country. I think American surplus has created American sloth. And it's time to get back to what made us great to begin with, and that's hard freaking work, right? I mean, and that's really what the objective of the book was, is to return back to the hardcore truth. I mean, your life, everybody listening right now, your waistline, your bank balance, your relationships, your reputation, the size of your business, is your own damn fault. I mean, good or bad, we are all self-made, and it comes back down to what you talked about, the number one control factor in our life, the profound success is result of small, smart choices completed consistently over time that compound into your waistline, your bank balance, the size of your business, the intimacy of your relationships, and so forth.
You know, another big problem that we have, too, is we forgot about ourselves. And when I say we forgot about ourselves, let's go back to the sleepwalking again. Our definition of perfection happens to be somebody else's definition. I can only be at my optimum. I can only, Darren, I can only be the second best you. At my best, I cannot be the first best you. So I've got to go out there and be the first best Michael Ray. And the key is most people don't get that. They're trying to be somebody else's definition of perfection, and it doesn't work. You can only be one you, and that's what we've gotten away from, being yourself and going out there and being the best you can be.
Yeah, you talk about sleepwalking. I mean, I mentioned the fact that the control center of your entire life, all your outcomes in life, come down to the choices you're making. But the problem is that 95% of all the choices we're making are completely unconscious. We're not even aware of the choices we're making. It's kind of like in the beginning when you were learning to drive and you had to have your right hand here and your left hand there and this foot had to do that and this one had to do this, look in these mirrors. That's all you could do was to focus on driving. Well, today, I mean, you're talking to the person next to you. You might be eating. You might be putting on your makeup. God forbid, texting. You don't even have to think about driving anymore. Well, most of us are just sleepwalking through our entire lives, not even realizing that we have these habits that are sabotaging, continually derailing us from the direction we're trying to take our lives. And it's about waking up. There are some trigger points to sort of wake you up so that you see what it is that you're doing that might be sabotaging. Even though you have great ambitions and great desires to go in a certain direction, you might not even realize that you're constantly being pulled off course by some of these unconscious habit patterns you have.
Sure, and the neural connections that we're talking about are shaped by your relationships, the culture that we're in, and all of those things that we see and are suggestive to us, and has to do with how you bring it in, how you process it, how you've reacted to it before 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, and you're still reacting today. Sleepwalking really means you're not living today, you're living 20 years ago, and you're living your life steering down the highway of life with your hands on the rearview mirror and getting into a lot of accidents, and you don't know why.
Yeah. Our habits are like the growth of a tree. In the very beginning, it's easy to sort of pull the sapling from the ground, but the longer you let that tree grow, it can grow into a mighty oak, whether the the root system is deep into the ground, and when you try to change some of those habits, it could be like trying to take that tree from the ground. You've been building that tree or those habits for 10, 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 years, and that's why it's difficult to change those habits. And inside the book, I realized that that is a formidable task, and there are 7 specific strategies to sort of go about uprooting those bad habits that will take you off course and have been probably for decades, and then how to install the success habits you need in order to take you in the direction you want to go.
Okay, I want to go to page 109. See, I've memorized the entire book. Registering your rhythm. Rhythm, rhythm, rhythm. Rhythm is so critical, and you created the rhythm register. How does that help?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Aristotle said, our lives are what we repeatedly do, right? You know, our habits end up forming the outcomes of our lives. And a lot of times to start creating new habits, you have to put them into routines, things that you will do automatically without having to think about it. So that there are a certain set of systems that you're going through where you're not having to make a decision about them each time. You're not having to suffer the willpower in order to determine whether you're actually going to see it through or not. And let me see if I could boil it down to something everybody can take with them right now today. I call it my massive transformation formula. There's a theory that you can create a massive transformation in any area of your life by the change of one behavior. That's true if you want to improve your sales, improve your marriage, improve your business, improve your leadership. Probably one behavior that if you did it consistently would totally transform the outcomes of that particular goal. So if you take your top 3 goals, and then you just decide what's the one behavior for each goal that if you did it consistently would transform your results to be able to make that goal a possibility. And then the third step is just track that behavior. And so the rhythm register is a way to sort of roll up all your goals in life down to the top 3, the top behavior for each, and then a tracking system to be sure that you're doing those things day in, day out, week in and week out, and it's all on a single piece of paper, and it takes less than 5 minutes to sort of manage and monitor whether you have done what it is that you set out to do at the end of the day. And if you keep track of it long enough, like a gyroscope, a plane leaving L.A. and trying to get to New York is constantly redirecting itself to stay on course. Over a period of time, the compound effect kicks in. If you've stayed on course, you end up arriving at these what seem like seemingly impossible goals because of the day-to-day management and monitoring system that's called that weekly rhythm register. And you can get that for free. It's on thecompoundeffect.com/free. And it's something somebody can download and get for themselves for free.
Well, say that one more time slowly.
Thecompoundeffect.com/free. And it's the weekly rhythm register, and they can download it there for free.
Okay, wonderful. And by the way, you know, you talk about doing a media diet. You got a kind of an interesting catch-22 with that. To begin with, I absolutely agree to a media diet because you get, again, so bombarded with information that they know exactly how to touch you. They know how to touch your unconscious. They know how to motivate you without you even know you're being motivated. So that said, the other side of that is we get so much different information based on the shows that we watch, CNBC, Fox News, NBC. Everybody's got a different political or ideological slant. So it's very confusing that way, too. But if you stay away from it, you'll never know what's going on, and then it can sneak up on you. So there's got to be a way to filter.
Yeah, you'd be surprised about how you can be in touch with the world without actually having to listen to all the noise out there. I mean, your friends, family, the conversations in the hallways, at the cocktail party, at the, you know, the chit-chat before a meeting, you get a sense of what's going on in the world. I don't listen to or watch any media at all whatsoever. I mean, I don't want my head full of the junk. It's such a nasty blood sport media is because they're all fighting for your attention. And they know the only way to get your attention is through the most shocking, most sensational, most lewd, most controversial, most scandalous. They're just looking for the 12 most perverted things that happened in the world that day. And then morning, noon, and night, miraculous, wonderful, beautiful things in the world happen that you don't hear anything about. And so it's not necessary to fill your head full of that crap. My personal philosophy is there's the world, and then there's my world. And I can do anything about the world. Like, you know, what happened in Washington, what's going on with the president. There's nothing I could do to alter that. But there is something I could do about being the president of my house and running my economy and taking care of my health care. Those are the things I can control. So that's where I spend my time and attention. Your life will go in the direction that you focus your attention towards. And the last place I want to focus towards is all the nasty, tragic disasters and scandals that are taking place in the world.
Oh, absolutely. And just a quick example of how neuromarketing works and just a little something for everybody to consider next time you watch something. If you watch any commercial, and for the most part, you're going to see this, you got a conscious and a subconscious mind. Your conscious mind is you're watching what's going on. You're literal. You're there. If you're a man and watch this, because you'll see it happen time and again, you will watch a woman with a great looking rear end walk across the screen. Inevitably, 70% of the ads you'll see, if you don't know about it, you don't think about it, you don't see it, but then you'll see it. Your eyes go to that. While your conscious eyes are on that, unconsciously, what they are saying to you gets fed into that unconscious, and you act on it. That's how a lot of the marketing works. When you say you're asleep when it's going on, yes, you are. And that part of you that you're not aware of catches this information, and then you act on it.
Yeah, I mean, a good example is let's say you had an 8-year-old little girl and you were having a dinner party and you were in the kitchen preparing dinner, and then you walked in and there one of your guests had your child, you know, sitting right in front of them, and they were telling him about murders and disasters and hurricanes and tragedies and scandals and corruption, and they were filling her head full of all of these details. You would promptly ask that guest to leave.
Sure.
Well, that guest is in front of your 8-year-old, because your mind actually operates like an 8-year-old. It doesn't filter or vet anything. It just holds whatever you put into it. And you have that guest speaking that kind of lewdness to your 8-year-old every day, day in and day out, in the middle of your living room, in your car, you know, on the papers that arrive at your doorstep. And, you know, it's insane. It's truly insane. And that's one of the objectives we have at Success Magazine, is through the fog of all the negative, sensational, worrisome, dangerous, and scandalous, you know, news and information that's out there, at least there's one beacon of hope, of light, of prosperity, to find out what's right with the world, the people doing amazing, incredible things, life-changing work in the world despite overcoming great odds. And it's another, you know, this show here, at least you're illuminating the best of human potential versus what news is doing is illuminating the most deprived part of our human nature. And so, you know, again, your life will go in the direction in which you focus your attention. It's really critical that you control your attention so that you can control your life.
Absolutely. And we have the word choice, the word option comes up. And Darren, there's so many choices and options that we have that we're not aware of. It's not what we don't know that gets us in trouble. It's what we don't know that we don't know. And with all of this information going on, we do have the control. A parent can turn off the TV, turn off the radio, do whatever the case may be. You can't control it once the child leaves the house. And there are things that are going on now that we say free speech. So therefore, you can say anything you want to say, which in some of these things are... We'll leave that aside. But the point of contention is when you're at home, you set the pattern. You talk patterns. A pattern can be set with that child of what's good and bad, what should and shouldn't be done. And when they go through life, the very things that we talk about, the problems that we have that cause us to get into trouble, can be reversed, and the kid can be taught the other way so they have that shield. So when it does come in, they do have the protection. And that's the
parent's response. Yeah, I mean, a parent can teach values. They can provide the prism in which the child will then see the world, filter in which they will take in what the world will thrust upon it. You know, they can't guide and shield and protect it from the reality of the world, but they can install a value system, and they can install a belief system about their own identity and their place in the world, that they can see the rest of the world through this prism of some sense. Sensible self-identity and sense of confidence. That's obviously the responsibility of the parent, not to protect them from all the evils of the world, because, you know, that's a time bomb waiting to happen.
Yeah. Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, with your experience when we did your bio, the compound effect, jumpstart your income, your life, and your success. I have been doing this for many, many, many years now, and the one thing that I have found, Darren, that a book, whether it's fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, it really doesn't matter. Once someone decides to put something to pen, they get into it, and there comes that moment in the writing, whatever the subject is, there's that aha, that cathartic moment where they realize something about the subject matter that they weren't aware of going in. Where was that for you? Where was that moment for you when you put this to pen and you went, oh, I didn't know that?
Well, I originally wrote it to sort of be a positioning statement for how, as publisher of Success Magazine, we had newly acquired the magazine, and we wanted to basically state our claim of this is how we see our responsibility as individuals, this is how we see our place in the world. It was sort of a positioning statement. But where it really came is when I identified my enemy. And my enemy was sensational news media. My enemy was commercial marketing gimmickry and the influence, the detrimental, crushing potential influence that it has on our consciousness, thus our the constant repeating cycle that we're creating within our society. And that was the moment of sort of illumination for me. That's where I really sort of got that why power of, okay, you know, this is an important message. Then I want to bring people back to just the fundamentals of what it takes to really earn success, not to, you know, buy it or imagine there's some silver bullet or to think that there's been some secret that's been buried for 2,000 years that's been recently unearthed and released for worldwide revelation. I mean, all that stuff is such marketing crap. And so, no, it was really about what I was fighting against so that I got clear about what I was fighting for.
Wonderful. Hey, Darren Hardy, we're just about out of time. Again, website we can find you at, get the book, and follow along with what you're doing.
TheCompoundEffect.com is where you can find the book. And the blog is wildly popular. I've got tens of thousands of entrepreneurs from all over the world following it. And you can find it at Darren Hardy, DarrenHardy.success.com. So just DarrenHardy.success.com. And those are the two plus best places to sort of keep up with my musings.
Wonderful. Hey, Darren, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on a high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It is far beyond the stars, it is near beyond the moon, and I know beyond a doubt, my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dixon Arnett with us, worked in politics and education for over 40 years now. He's the author of Galahad's Quest, Can a Candidate for President Win as an Independent? Hey, Dixon, welcome to the show.
Well, my thanks for your having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know what this reminds me of? Did you see, oh, it was years ago, remember Robert Redford in The Candidate?
I do indeed. Yeah, quite dramatically.
Yes, and I remember the end of that, which always stayed with me. Obviously, they put him up because they didn't think he'd win. Whatever happened, he won. So he wins the election. He's in the car with everybody on the way back, and he's laughing. And they said, what are you laughing at? He said, now what do I do?
And that is true of so many candidates, even the best ones in the world, because in campaigns, people have a chance to be somewhat general and flamboyant and try to make an impression in a few words. And then they get to the office when they get there, and I've had this happen to me to some extent, and even though you've enunciated your platform and you've given speeches and tried to excite audiences and so forth, you get there and you say, well, now, wait a minute, how do I actually write this piece of legislation? And then you're up against it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I want to go back years and years ago. I remember there would be people who would they'd want to run for office. They've decided not necessarily president, but they wanted to run, you know, in local offices. And I watched them come in. I sat down, I face to face, crossed the desk. Well, you know, I did the interviews and I watched them with the I'm mad and I want to change things. You never vote for anybody who says that because they don't know what's going on. But the key is they and then when they did get into office, that they missed one thing and one thing only. Once you get in, it has nothing to do with what you say individually. It has to be a collective thought pattern that causes something to move forward. You've got to be able to agree with a lot of people to get any kind of an agenda done, and that's what they don't realize going in. The power of one doesn't work in politics.
Well, that's and the system is set up that way, but and you do get sort of a humility once you're there along those very same lines, which is part of how my book starts, which is to say we're in a situation now, and my protagonist in the book enunciates this, where we are at the extremes, and we have boxed ourselves in to the extremes in so many ways, so to the point where that what you've described is an attitude that is not generally understood even by many people who are in public office, elected public office these days.
Sure.
They are drawing lines in the sand, and they're saying, I won't compromise, I won't negotiate. And sometimes you have to measure your own good wishes against one another and choose.
Sure. And Dixon, the other thing that I saw over the years, you know, I would interview someone, and then let's say they get in office, and then the term was up, they'd campaign again, and they got back into office again, running about the second time. And right around that time with the interview, they weren't the same person. There was a euphoria. It was almost like a drug. That person changed completely from that original person that I interviewed to what they were 6, 7, 8 years later. So it was a very interesting transition that they go through. So when we deal with politics today, and I say it from an outsider, but when we deal with it today, there is a system that they go through, and if they haven't got that quote-unquote chemical component in their mind, they're not going to make it.
Well, that's true. Change to a certain degree is born of learning, of course, and you do learn in office, and you grow in office, and that's one of the things that people should look for when they are considering candidates. But it is also something where you have to be anchored to a certain degree in what you believe in.
Yeah.
And yet there is a compromise even there. In other words, what you believe in strongly does not mean that you cannot learn and change over time. You have to, however, be able to explain that to people and be very honest about it, excruciatingly honest about it, because that is a habit that occurs to all of us in all of our lives, whatever profession we go into, even in our family lives. So a change by itself is not a bad thing, but you surely, particularly when you're in public office, better be able to explain yourself and say why.
Well, absolutely. And I really think today that what it comes down to is this. My sister, and I don't want to get political left, right, it doesn't really matter at this point, but my sister does not like Barack Obama. I mean, she doesn't like him to a point where if she hears his voice, she'll turn off the television. Okay, that said, the point I want to make is this, that I walked over to her one day in the last couple, 3 weeks, and I said, if he offered you $25,000 to vote for him, would you vote for him? She said, in a hot minute. And if he gives me $100,000, I'll go out and I'll do his campaign. See, the key is this. We have gotten to a point whereby we look at our political officials or those people, the wannabes, and we say, what are you going to give me? And the person who gives me the most is the one I'm going to vote for. That's a shame, Dixon, but that's what we ended up with today.
Well, I'm afraid that's true. We're in an atmosphere, well, to some degree true. We're in an atmosphere where campaigning is constant. The amount of money it takes to run for public office grows exponentially every 2 years. The redistricting that takes place in the states pushes people into Democratic or Republican districts, which means that the election is really conducted in the primary, not the general election.
Sure.
And way too often. And as a result, you get this sort of anger on the part of the voters, which is to a certain degree justified because you've got this inertia in Congress and in many state legislatures. The most recent example, Congress creates a super committee. When in doubt, create a committee.
Sure.
And they are incapable of coming to any kind of agreement while Social Security trust funds and Medicare trust funds and tax policies, all of which are a part of the solution, and there's examples of how to get to that solution, are just left on the table.
Sure.
Well, they go on to the blame game, and that's not the first time this has ever happened, but my argument in my book, in the beginning of my book, is that this has become endemic in the system, and if we're ever going to get the solutions to our problems, we better figure out how to fix the system first.
Now, by the way, the system has learned to spend money, quote unquote. When you have a president, and it doesn't even have to be Obama, but if you have a president right in the middle of this disaster that's going on economically, and if the Congress can't make a decision, they have to work through the holidays, who goes on vacation, for 17 days? You see, there in and of itself is a problem because we get to a point as an elected official that we can do what we want to do and we forget who is working for who. Recently, the inside trading problems was coming up with about, I think it was 11 or 12 of the politicians. Pelosi wasn't involved in it, and so was John Boehner. So we have these things going on that politics has turned into something that the average person has no concept of, they don't understand.
It used to be that when you ran for like the state legislature or the city council or the county board of supervisors, something like that, you were doing it much like you would join a civic club.
Yeah.
You were doing it as a matter of conscience and service to the common weal. And today it's become a profession. I remember when I was in the California State Assembly, I served 4 terms, 2-year terms, and then I decided it was time for me to turn it over to somebody else. Not that I had lost my interest, but because I had, I felt an obligation to be civic-minded about it. And the other part of that, of course, is that I had to turn it over to a successor in better shape, I believed, than I had received it.
Yeah. And by the way, what we're dealing with also today is this. The accusations, the rest of it. I think when the Tea Party first started out, and they're still like that today, the Tea Party was the independent. Those were the ones who said, we don't like the left, we don't like the right, we don't like what's going on, we want people back in, etc. Then it started. There were Nazis and they were racists and so on and so forth. The words came out. Then the next shot was this the Wall Street protesters, the sit-ins, got compared to the Tea Party. That is nothing like the Tea Party. But what goes on are the lies, the campaigns, the things that we have to listen to, where for the most part it's not true. And I think an independent candidate, which I think would be wonderful at this stage of the game, would have a tough time going in. A, they'd have to create a tremendous amount of money to compete, number one. And number two, they'd have to have something that was so valuable to the individual voter that the voter would take that compelling reason to move forward and vote for them.
Well, there's no question about it. Over the last 30 years, the trend in voters for re-registering as an independent or a minor party is now grown to almost 1/4 of all voters. Yeah. And so you just do the math on that and think plurality, not majority, and you think that the Electoral College awards winner take all in 40 out of 50 states on the basis of whoever gets the most votes. Well, that can be a plurality. Yeah. And as a result, a person who is popular, well-known, this is the protagonist in my novel, who has an ability at public speaking and has the ability to raise competitive sums, forget the parties, forget the conventions. They're meaningless anymore. Forget the partisan invective and go straight to the general election. And if he or she has got 15% or better of the vote in national polls, according to the Presidential Commission on Debates, they can participate. So imagine, what if in presidential debates this fall, if you chose to look at it that way, although my book does not, isn't specific to a particular year, nevertheless, in today's context, what if there were three candidates debating on the presidential debates and not two? You'd have a whole different conversation.
You know, somebody came up with an idea, Dixon, some years back that I would love to see implemented. It never will be, but it would start out on a local level. Let's say the mayor. You'd have five people who were vying for the mayor's position, and everybody in the city would vote for all five of them. And the person with the least amount of votes would be eliminated. And then everybody else would vote for the four that were left. The person with the least amount of votes would be eliminated all the way to that top person. And then it would be totally fair, and there wouldn't be the garbage that is going on today. It would eliminate all of it. It would eliminate the campaign funds, the this, the that, and the whatever. And it would get right down to who everybody liked. Then we have to add this to the mix, the Electoral College.
Well, that would force the candidates to really address the issues. And the fact is, they do, in local elections, have this kind of system in Australia. And the people, I think, that you're referring to who first advocated this kind of system, at least at the local level in our country, was the League of Women Voters about 30 years ago. But there's much to recommend it.
I knew there was something I liked about them.
Well, they do some of the best political and public issue research in the country.
Well, by the way, where about in California? Go ahead.
I'm in San Diego.
Oh, okay. All right. Have you been there for a long time?
About 12 years now. I used to live in Northern California when I was active in politics. And as my bio says, I put in 40 years or so in elected and appointed offices, local, state, and federal. And have had a marvelous experience, but have been saddened by what the situation has become over the years in the sense of this disorientation on the part of the electorate and the dysfunction in some of our legislative bodies. I'm impatient with that, and with a certain amount of knowledge I know that and experience, I know that I don't have to be. And I'm disappointed that what's happened since my own public service and elective office many years ago. I don't cotton to the extremes the way they've become. In some ways, even more people becoming independent leaves the individual two parties, the Republicans and Democrats, becoming more extreme because independents in most states don't vote in the primaries. So you've got a sort of a dichotomy going on here where, on the one hand, unhappy voters disjointing themselves from the two major political parties and becoming independents has ironically created a situation where the extremes have become more extreme.
Sure, no question about it. By the way, our secret here, don't tell anybody, I remember San Diego when it was a little sleepy town of 50,000. You drive in from L.A.
And so do I.
Nothing but beach communities. And by the way, I came from the most famous city in Southern California.
Which was?
Bell.
Which was San Diego?
Where the mayor and the police chief are off to jail. Yeah. I was brought up in the world. Yeah, but it wasn't like that in those days. Okay. By the way, we're just about out to. Well, let me ask you this: website we can find you at and buy the book.
www.galahadsquest, all one word, no apostrophe, .com, and that tells you, well, both the publisher's hype and a few words of my own about the book, but you can tell I'm kind of passionate about this subject. And,
and
with the presidential race being what it is, even as quirky as it is, the book is picking up a lot of steam.
Wonderful. And by the way, and thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time, and I love the subject matter. I really do, and I think you're spot on with this.
Well, I'm delighted that you feel that way. I'm delighted to have had this interview, and maybe we should do it sometime next summer after the primaries are over and revisit.
Absolutely, no question. Radio Susie sitting here, and her head's going, yes, I like it. All right, great. So
we'll talk. Radio Susie's been wonderful in setting this up, and thank you both.
Okay, thank you so much, and take care. Good night.
Good night.
I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago. Once upon a time, we sat beneath a willow tree, counting all the stars and waiting for the dawn. But that was once upon a time. Now the tree is gone. How the breeze.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ken Wallace with us, the author of The Keeper of the Keys, taking a hell out of self-help. He's got 2 decades in successful personal development consulting, coaching, and speaking, graduate of Illinois Wesleyan University, Master of Divinity degree with honors from Drew University, and graduate work at Oxford University, Oxford, England, the University of, and I can't say that, so Ken, I'm going to try it out. The University of, would you say it for me?
Tübingen.
Tübingen. Okay, I knew that. In Germany and the Drew University Graduate School. Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael. I appreciate it.
Now, by the way, when we deal with this, when we really take a look at it, what are we looking at when we talk about self-help? Is there any such thing in reality?
There is, because we all have a choice. And really, self-help to me is helping people make better choices. Every time you get up in the morning, you make a choice. Well, in one case, the night before, when you're going to get up if you set the alarm. If you don't, then that's a choice, right? You're just going to get up when you wake up. And then from that point forward, are you going to get out of bed and when and what you're going to do, what you're going to wear, what you're going to eat, where you're going to go, what you're going to do, and all of these are choices. But it's so much a part of life that we don't even know that what we choose really impacts the rest of our day and, in fact, the rest of our life. So self-help helps folks make better choices on a daily basis.
Well, I'm going to give you my take on self-help, and I've felt this for a lot of years. It's not what we don't know that gets us in trouble. It's what we don't know that we don't know. And there's an adage that I've lived by for many, many years now, that a good leader knows when to follow, and a good teacher knows when to be a student. I change hats 3-4 times a week easily, because that's how we create the wisdom out of the things that we learn. That said, we need mentors. People who do know, people who can look over our shoulder, look at our world through different eyes, and allow us to see what we didn't see before. So I don't really believe self-help. I believe somebody needs to hold your hand for a while to get you the feeling of which way to go, and then you move forward.
I agree with that. I agree with, because in that regard, if you're talking about helping yourself, like if you're in a hole trying to pull yourself up and nobody lifting you up from a higher plane,
yeah,
then I agree. You do have to have that hand up before you really understand what you've already got. And if you can see yourself in a different way and your possibilities that you didn't see before because somebody else opened that up to you, then I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, because when it really comes down to it, where you know, you have expertise in your field, I have expertise in mine, and people have different expertises. But if you put me behind your desk for a day, if I just walked in cold, I would get totally lost. So I would need, quote unquote, symbolically, I would need you holding me by the hand and guiding me through until I got the feel of it. And I think that's really what it is. It's getting familiar with a different way to look at things. And I think that's the impetus of all help.
That's right. What we have that is most unique to each of us is our own perspective on life and experience. And when we can share that with others and help them see things that they hadn't seen before, to look at their own past and their own experiences in a different way, so that just slightly, maybe cast a little different light on them, so that it's not so dark and so unmeaningful, or help them to understand that there's a different kind of meaning that's been lost on them before, then their lives become a whole lot better and their future becomes a whole lot brighter.
With all the work you've done with everybody, coaching and everything that you've studied and the people that you've talked to, is there an overarching obstacle? Is there something that you find that has commonality with most people that they just have the worst time getting over? Either they don't see it or it's just something too tough to deal with.
I don't think it's too tough to deal with, but yes, there is a common theme that robs many people of a joyous future, a joyous present, and that is their self-concern, in particular, their concern with what other people think of them. And when they are not aware that they are enslaved to that concern, then they go through life making these choices to please other people and to conform to their expectations or your perceived expectations of how they want you to behave and how they want you to be. It's like growing up and my mother always instilled in me, because at an early age I announced that I wanted to be a minister. And so she said that that was a good thing, and she encouraged that, and I prepared all the way through my education for that and became that. And about 21 years ago, I left the professional ministry, but all through my life, I had pretty much defined myself as a minister. in large measure because I was encouraged to do so by my mother and others around me. So if I were earlier in my age, in my stage of life, saying, I need to do something different, that would have brought me into conflict with people I love dearly. But later on, I understood that I needed to be called out of the ministry, not just into it. And so I began to realize I need to make my own choices, and regardless of what other people thought of them. And in making that decision to leave the full-time ministry, or at least the professional ministry, it crossed a few swords with people, and I had to go my own way.
Yeah, but when you really down to it, when you get into the occupation that you're in now, you're still ministering, aren't you?
It is. Oh, I agree. As a matter of fact, the founder of Methodism, John Wesley, said when he was, because when they were ordained in England at the time, about 250, 300 years ago, whenever he started, they were supposed to be in one parish. But what he did was he traveled on horseback from place to place and preached in different parishes upon their invitation. That brought him crossways with several people saying, you can't do that. And he said, well, the whole world is my parish.
Yeah.
And I agree with that because I am now in a different kind of ministry, in a different venue, in different several different venues that I could never have been had I stayed in the pastoral ministry. That's true.
Yeah. And when you really come down to it, if you're working with people, whether it be personal, whether it be business, in any venue, if you're leading them to have a better, more successful life, that's really quote unquote, I happen not to be Christian, but that happens to be the gospel. If you're allowing somebody to see some kind of light and making light better for that life, better for them, what more could you ask for?
Exactly. As we were saying, as you introduced earlier on in our conversation about helping people see themselves differently so that they can have different choices in life, I would say better choices, to become their better selves, so that now they can make a choice to go in a different direction that will be more fulfilling.
And I think one of the most important things in life to get there, the very first step, the component in which you have expertise in, is communication. Being able to say something in a way that they heard what you meant by what you said, as opposed to what they think they meant by what you said, which gets so many people confusing, whether it's business or personal.
Exactly. Yeah, communication is the key, because so much of the time people assume that just because they can talk, they can communicate, or that just because they have spoken, that what was intended to be heard by the person they were speaking to was in fact heard. So I encourage people to, in the course of especially business communication, to adopt what's called perception checking, so that it's simple, and a lot of people do it sometimes without knowing that they're doing it, but many people don't. And that is, in fact, checking the other person's perception of what you have just communicated to see if, in fact, they did receive the message you intended to communicate. And by doing that, then all kinds of problems are averted.
No question. And I really believe in language in and of itself. It has to be familiar to the person that you are talking to, because one of the biggest problems that we have, again, personal or business, is miscommunication. It doesn't mean, again, that they heard it in the way that you meant it. I think one of the greatest ways to do that is to do an illustration after you've made a point, either a small story, an example, or something that allows people to create the image for what you said. I've used this example on the air before, but if I say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means?
Chamber around. That has something to do with firing a gun, I would believe.
Yeah, absolutely. See, if somebody's not familiar with it, they wouldn't have a matching mental image, wouldn't mean anything to them. But if you said put a bullet in a gun, now you got the picture of the bullet, you got the picture of the gun. The bullet is the round, the chamber is where it fits. So it's got to be familiar, and a quick illustration after you've made the point usually will get the point across.
And backing up as far as a philosophical approach to communication that opens up to me is that we all think, like I said, just because we can speak, we can communicate and have done so when we've spoken. That's not true. We need to, in our communications, root ourselves in this concept, and that is what we know very well. Others might not know at all or as well. So if I know that as I'm communicating, like, for instance, jargon, chamber around, that means something to me. But if I'm conscious in my communication that to someone else it may not mean what it does to me, or that they're just totally confused, then not only just looking at their face, because sometimes the quizzical expression will indicate, hey, I need to say something else to clarify, but if I'm philosophically rooted in my communication, saying, I know what I'm trying to say very well, but others may not know at all or as well what I'm using in the way of language and phraseology. If I do that, then I'm going to make sure that they understand in several different ways, including, as you were mentioning, saying it in different words and or just ask the question, can you repeat to me what I've said to you? And then find out, in fact, if the message was understood.
Yeah, and there's another component of this also, and it's brain science, and it's the neurons. It's those mirror neurons that allow you to recognize something, because what happens, you say something, and if it's recognizable, they fire up, and all of a sudden you've got a communication going with somebody. If it's not recognizable, they don't imitate, they don't mirror that action, they don't have the mental picture and also the trigger of the emotional response that you're looking for with the agreement. So there's a lot to communication than just words. There's the psychological effect, there's the neurological effect, there's the emotional effect, I mean, the behavioral effect. I mean, this thing goes on and on and on. But it's really simple when you get down to it and have a base understanding of it. And in business, one of the problems I think happens today is the communication isn't there, which affects bottom line at the end of the day.
That's correct. That's correct. Part of that philosophical grounding, too, is, I suppose the best way to put it is in the words of Mark Twain, it's not so much what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we know for sure that just ain't so. So a lot of the times when we're communicating with somebody, and we've been in a situation, let's say we're talking politics, and somebody's far right and the other one's far left. Well, they're not going to really communicate no matter how much they talk with each other, because they're really always going to be talking at each other, either trying to convince that the other person is wrong or trying to bring them over into their camp. And so in that case, it's, you know, I know for sure that this is correct. In that case, when you're trying to communicate with someone, you have to understand what their filter of reality is, and what they believe to be the case, even if you know that they're confused by the facts. As my father always used to say, don't confuse me with the facts, my mind's made up.
Let's not trip on the facts here. By the way, we're starting to run out of time. Ken, one of the things I learned about myself about 3 or 4 days ago when you were talking about politics and communication, I happen to be a moderate Republican, And I heard somebody give a definition of me. I'm somebody who hates women and loves guns. Now I know who I am.
Well, isn't that so descriptive?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, Ken, do you have a website we can find you at?
You bet. It's Ken Wallace Company. This company is spelled out C-O-M-P-A-N-Y, KenWallaceCompany.com. You can also go to betterthanyourbest.com and yourbetterself.com.
Wonderful. And we can get the book there.
You can get the book at KenWallaceCompany.com. You can go on any of the online retailers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. I've got a second book as well, which is a study guide based on the first one.
Got it. Ken, we got to go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
We'll linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again,
would spend it with you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your tears and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. People say I was made for this. Nothing else would I trade for this. And just think,